Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And this evening we're going to have with us Steve Henninger, a friend of ours from many years past, who used to live here in the area where we live and go to our church. But now he's, of course, working up in the Washington area there. And he is certainly knows something about what's happening as far as the nuclear industry. He was trained in nuclear engineering when he was in the military. And we're going to be talking about a revolutionary idea. Well, it's really not revolutionary. It's something that's done in every other country. It is what's logical when you're dealing with the nuclear industry. But we've been told for many years, we can't have nuclear power plants because, after all, if we had nuclear power plants, what would we do with the spent fuel? Oh, my goodness, we've got it just sitting around in 50-gallon barrels, and those 50-gallon barrels are beginning to rust, and of course, the plumes of the contaminated water are getting into the aquifer and will soon be contaminating our rivers and streams, and we don't know what to do with it. We can't put it in Yucca Mountain because although they've calculated what's going to happen in 10,000 years, what's going to happen in 250,000 years is something ridiculous. And of course, what they never tell the American people, because they, being the people who control the media, and we have freedom of the press, and if you have freedom of the press, it means why you have the freedom to suppress whatever information you want to. And because there's been an organized effort for the better part of 40 years to prevent the development of nuclear energy in the United States, what they do not tell you is that what you do with the spent nuclear fuel is you reprocess it. Simplest thing in the world. We had the facilities to do it until the time of the Carter administration, and the plants were simply disbanded. Government, after private industry had invested some $4 billion in reprocessing plants, why Congress passed a law that they couldn't do it, and certainly under the Reagan administration, why they reversed that law. However, the company said, well, we're not going to put more money unless you promise you won't reverse this again, and you'll buy the plutonium and other products we produce, and oh no, we couldn't do that. And so all this time, for going back for 30 years or more, we have not reprocessed any of our fuel, and that's why it's sitting around in 50-gallon drums. Well, with that as a background, Steve, it's so good to have you with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on, Steph.
Why don't you give us the background of what's going on? Because I understand that now they're beginning to talk about what's doing logical, what needs to be done.
There's a program that was started last year, sometime 2006, called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And just, I guess, first off, I am not a spokesman for the Department of Energy or any of the companies involved or anything like that. I'm just speaking as a private citizen. So anyways, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP as it's called, it's all public record, and they have the DOE has websites with all kinds of information and stuff about it. And one of the primary thrusts of it is, as you discussed there in your opening, they're talking about recycling our spent nuclear fuel, or reprocessing it, as sometimes called. And currently we have what's called a once-through fuel cycle. So we create fuel rods for the reactors around the country, and they use them for 18 to 24 months.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
You go right ahead, Steve.
Okay. So they use the fuel for 18 to 24 months, and then they shut down the reactor and take the fuel out and put a new batch in, and that fuel then gets stored on site at whatever commercial power plant is using it. So the commercial power plants all over the country, there's I think 104, 105 of them still in operation. They sort of stockpile this spent nuclear fuel in containers there at their facility. And this fuel is still rich in energy. There's lots of uranium left in it. There's lots of plutonium in it. There's lots of other isotopes called transuranic elements that, if the technology were completed, would be very useful for energy itself. And the current plan, as far as I know, is to just dig a big hole in the bottom of Yucca Mountain in Nevada and bury all this stuff.
But that's illogical. Why bother to do that when you've already got the nuclear material there? You don't. It wouldn't have to mine it out of the ground. I mean, it's there. It's just sitting there, and it's just simply being destroyed. And you know, really, I'm sure in places it is being to leak out of the 50-gallon drums, and there may be contamination in the aquifer. And this is all totally unnecessary. None of this had to happen. Why have they blocked the reprocessing of the nuclear fuel, which is what every other country in the world does?
Well, not every other country, but certainly several of them. Great Britain and France and Russia reprocess for sure. I would imagine China does, and probably Japan. But the President Carter, back in the late 70s, signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act. And as part of that act, we ceased all forward progress on reprocessing as a nation.
But why would you have done that? I mean, this is what's created the whole problem, blocking what was logical and should have been done.
Well, the official position, I guess, of the government, at least from what I've read, is that the reason for non-proliferation, or the reason that reprocessing has stopped, is to minimize proliferation of nuclear materials. But, I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because we create nuclear materials at processing facilities, and so reprocessing is not a whole lot different. And in reprocessing, actually, and part of the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership is we would start reprocessing this fuel, and we would also, in a partnership...
Hold that thought in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Steve was just saying that this global reprocessing program, we would begin to reprocess all of this vast amount of nuclear fuel we have all across America. And as he points out, that ordinarily, you know, you'd have this nuclear fuel, you'd use it for a couple of years, you'd remove it from the reactor, store it and put in new fuel, but all of this fuel is sitting out there, and it can be reprocessed and used again, and then reprocessed and used again, and so this can be used until most of it, the radioactive material is gone, and then with the small residual would be rather easy to store. But this has been effectively blocked because of some idea that they wanted to stop nuclear proliferation, and how that, I know, not reprocessing fuel is going to stop nuclear proliferation. I don't understand. Do you, Steve?
I don't actually understand the technicalities of it. And, you know, the bottom line is that the other major nuclear powers in the world do reprocess. And so far as I know, they don't have any loss of accountability or at least enough to raise any public concerns. And they've been doing it for years, for a long time. And so, I maybe to back up a little bit, that there's a lot of discussion of waste and, you know, leaching out and contaminated soil and stuff like that with radiation. I spent a lot of time working within the Department of Transportation's rules and shipping and moving around various hazardous materials. And the Department of Transportation considers radioactive material its most significant hazard. And a lot of that goes with public perception. You know, most radioactive material is either so low level that you get more radiation from the sun, you know, hanging out on the beach or flying in an airplane, or if it's high level, like spent nuclear fuel, is so well packaged that they have these containers that a single container has to, the very same container, has to be dropped from 30 feet, has to be stacked, you know, with a certain amount of weight on it, has to be twisted, has to be impacted, and then it has to be dropped to the bottom of like a 50-foot pool of water. And so this one container goes through all these tests, and then they pull it out of the water, and it has to pass a leak test. So it's called a Type B container, and when there's really nasty stuff inside of it, it's very, very well protected. And so these aren't just run-of-the-mill 55-gallon drums. And then the other thing about waste is most of your really high-level, it's called transuranic waste. These are the isotopes that are created during the fission process that are just sort of a byproduct of creating nuclear energy. And they have really long half-lives, you know, the millions of years, and they'll be around for a very long time. And these transuranic elements are sort of bound into the fuel. And so when you reprocess, you take these transuranic elements out. So all of this nasty stuff, all of these commercial power plants that have been producing electricity quite safely, quite efficiently, without any emissions for the last 40 or 50 years, all of the waste, all the spent nuclear fuel waste that they've created would cover about 2 football fields, about 4 yards deep. So we're not talking about a huge quantity. You know, when you compare it to landfills or other sources of pollution or environmental damage, we're talking a real small overall quantity. And if we reprocessed, we would turn the bulk of that, we'd cut it in half at least, if not more. And then part of the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, the GNEP program, is to revisit or rebuild a fast breeder reactor. And I don't know, Stan, if you want me to get very technical.
I wanted to get into the fast breeder. I'd sort of like to know what a fast breeder program would be.
Okay, so I'll come back to where I was going with this so we explain reactors a little bit. The process of fission takes a uranium or a plutonium atom, and it absorbs a neutron. It becomes unstable, and it splits in half. When it splits in half, it typically becomes uranium, at least we'll stick with that for simplicity. Uranium typically becomes either krypton or xenon. And it can actually become a lot of different things, but usually that's what it becomes. But if you took the krypton and the xenon and you put them back together, you wouldn't get a whole uranium atom. There's some mass missing. And that mass, according to Einstein's equation, mass or energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, that small amount of mass is converted into a large amount of energy. And most reactors, in fact, all of the operating reactors in this country are what's called a thermal reactor or a light water reactor, where when this fission occurs, the uranium splits in half, it spits out a couple of very fast neutrons. They're moving very fast. The neutrons collide with the hydrogen that's connected to the water in a light water reactor, and like a billiard ball, the energy is transferred to the hydrogen, and the neutron slows down. When it gets to a point where it's called thermal, it's moving pretty slow, just sort of floating around, that's the most efficient way for it to enter into another uranium atom. And so light water reactors are very efficient as far as their fission goes, so their neutron life cycle.
Isn't the basic idea that you put the fuel in, the fuel creates heat, the heat boils water, it becomes steam, and basically what you've done is form a steam-generating plant to generate electricity using as the source of heat to boil the water, uranium. Would that be a fair assessment for our listeners?
For a light water reactor, yes.
Right, okay.
Now, a breeder reactor typically uses some other coolant than water. So the one that I'm familiar with uses liquid sodium. And when you melt sodium and pure sodium and you turn it into a liquid, it behaves very much like water. It has a lot of similar characteristics as far as flow and heat transfer and stuff. But it does not thermalize the neutrons. It doesn't slow them down. And so you have to use a higher enriched fuel in order for it to work, but the idea is you create a ton of neutrons that are moving fast, and you just jam them into the uranium or plutonium or whatever your product is to force the fission. So it's not as efficient, but you can do a lot different things with it. And so that's kind of the difference between a fast reactor versus a thermal reactor. And then a breeder reactor is when you load your fuel in the beginning, you'll load it with uranium-235, and then you'll put a bunch of uranium-238 in there, which is much, much, much more common than uranium-235. 99.8 or 0.3 or something percent of all the uranium is 238, and so there's a real small quantity of the stuff that will fission. So anyways, you load 238 into your reactor, and in this fast reactor, and you force neutrons into the 238, and they will become plutonium-239. And so as you're burning your uranium-235, you're creating plutonium-239, which is another fuel material. And so your breeder reactor, as it's making heat, is also making more fuel. And so if you have a reprocessing facility, then you can take that fuel and take it and process the plutonium out of it and use the plutonium in a light water reactor for whatever. And so that's kind of basically how a fast reactor works. And so then back to this waste. This waste has all these transuranic elements in them that are very, very long-lived, millions of years in their radioactivity. And if you put them in a breeder reactor, you can technically, although we haven't pursued this, we sort of dropped this whole program in the early 90s, but you can force neutrons into these transuranic elements and force them to become other elements that have very short half-lives. Ultimately, you're trying to create lead as you burn this stuff out and cause it to fission or cause it to absorb or whatever happens in there. And so you turn this waste. So we started out with 2 football fields, 4 yards deep, of really, really nasty waste that is full of energy but not something you want to bring home and put in the living room. And so if we reprocess, we can cut that in half to begin with. And then if we implement the breeder reactor program, we have the technology to burn out all the really long-lived stuff. So your half that's left now lasts thousands of years instead of millions of years, and it's much more manageable.
Well, I think it's important for our listeners to understand that there is no reason not to have gone ahead and reprocessed our uranium, except that there was an organized effort 30 to 40 years ago, probably beginning in the late 1960s and extending into the early 1970s, to block the development of nuclear power. And they scared the American people to death with the tales of Three Mile Island. And isn't it interesting that the Three Mile Island incident just happened to occur at the same time that Hollywood put out a film called The China Syndrome with Jack Lemmon and Jane Fonda about, of course, a nuclear power plant accident? And they played games with our mind with the Three Mile Island incident. I always like to say far more people died in the backseat of Ted Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick than died at Three Mile Island. Nobody died.
You know, in fact, Three Mile Island, it's funny how the media sort of spins things around to their own agenda. Three Mile Island is a testimony to how safe reactors are.
Right.
And I'll explain why when we come back, because I can hear the music.
Well, I'll never forget going to a meeting one time and meeting a young man who, he was dead set against nuclear reactors, and he said, "Would you want to have a nuclear reactor in your backyard?" And I said, "Look, my son was on an aircraft carrier, and it was fueled by nuclear fuel. Every submarine, nuclear submarine, is fueled by nuclear fuel. People live right next to them, and they're not harmed at all." This young man became so furious, he stopped off yelling and screaming, because his mind had been conditioned by the media to believe a lie that, of course, nuclear power plants are dangerous. Well, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, well, so I was saying that, Three Mile Island, if the media had properly reported it with using facts.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
After mistake after mistake, and yet nobody was harmed, nobody was contaminated, and most of what you've read about that incident is simply lies, but it was really very effective. They wanted to shut down the nuclear power industry, they did, and here we are now 30 years or so, 35 years, 7 years later, and suddenly they're saying, oh shucks, well, we're just going to have to return to nuclear power, but you can be sure, in the meantime, the people with great wealth have bought up most of the industry and will be able to control it very effectively. And what has happened is that the wealth is going to go from weak hands to strong hands. This is what happens all the time. And they use the power of government and the power of the medium to convince people of a lie. Well, go ahead, Steve.
Just to be fair on the other side of the coin, the reactors in this country are very safe, as are the ones in the Navy. The Navy reactors are exceptionally safe, but they're also exceptionally expensive. The one reactor failure that actually caused some damage and a significant spread of contamination was the Chernobyl incident.
But they didn't have a nuclear, they didn't have a vesicle for controlling the spread of nuclear fuel. They had a tar and gravel roof instead
right,
of these
right,
and containment and so
that,
vessels.
That's my point, is that all reactors in this country are built inside what's called a containment dome. And the containment facilities are airtight, steel and concrete reinforced buildings that have to pass all kinds of seismic qualifications and, I mean, just extremely rigorous government standards that are regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so any accident that, so you could technically reproduce the situation that happened at Chernobyl, which I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but another really long series of deliberate actions. It, Three Mile Island, I'm not convinced was deliberate from what I've read, but Chernobyl was, whether deliberate through negligence or intention, I don't know, but was definitely deliberate to make it do what it did. Even if you reproduced those situations in an operating reactor in this country, you would not have the same effect because it would all be contained within inside the containment dome. And then the other comment that you briefly touched on and that I think is important for people to realize, that I was going to elaborate on, is that a nuclear reactor cannot blow up into a mushroom cloud. It does not have the physical geometry to ever explode in the way that a nuclear bomb explodes. But when you talk about nuclear reactors and you talk about nuclear bombs, those are not apples to apples. They are two totally different animals. The only thing they have in common is the type of fuel that they use, but the geometry of a reactor is actually designed specifically so that it cannot do that. There's no way that you could crash a plane into it or put a bomb underneath it or any sort of wild scenario anybody could come up with to force a nuclear reactor to explode like a nuclear bomb explodes.
But they've certainly managed to create that impression in people's minds, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. I get it in my own classes in college, and I have to end up correcting the instructors because there's a real natural tendency for the general public to try and equate a reactor to a bomb because it's all nuclear to them. But the reason that they jump to that conclusion right away is because the media, because the China syndrome, because movies. You know, I was watching K-19, The Widowmaker, a couple years ago with my wife, and I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's a pretty good movie. Harrison Ford, Russian sub, and they get to a point in the movie where the reactor engineer makes the comment to the captain, you know, if this situation continues, we could have thermonuclear explosion and blow up the American ship. And you know, I had to pause the movie at that point and tell my wife that was a ridiculous statement. It can't happen that way.
No, but they could certainly use that to implant the ideas in people's minds.
Sure.
And that's really what they do. They control our reality. They mold our mind. They influence our perceptions about everything. I mean, to equate a nuclear power plant for the nuclear bomb is simply dishonest. But that really doesn't matter. They wanted to block the development of nuclear energy in this country. They have kept it back for many years. And now suddenly they're saying, oh, shucks, well, we're just going to have to go ahead and go nuclear. And believe me, this is what's been planned all along. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, to Steve Henninger. Steve, go ahead with the story.
I was just commenting on how the media makes the public mentally equate nuclear energy with nuclear bombs, and I was just defending the point that it's just not possible. That most nuclear reactors don't even use a weapons grade of nuclear fuel. It's the weapons stuff has to be very, very, very pure, either plutonium or uranium-235, and most reactors are, I think, 5 to maybe 30% pure fuel, and that's as much as they refine it or enrich it, is what it's called, and it doesn't have the mass, it doesn't have the geometry, there's just no physical way for a reactor to become a bomb and to blow up like one.
Amen to that. Okay, and so now basically this global nuclear energy project, is this a function of the Department of Energy or what?
Yes, I was hoping to go back to the GNEP. The Department of Energy has set some extremely aggressive timetables to get this program rolling, and what they want to do is there are either 11 or 13 different sites, I can never get that one clear, around the country that have petitioned the Department of Energy to be the site. And so that right now the Department of Energy is doing what's called a programmatic environmental impact statement to see the feasibility of this program. And there's a couple of facilities that look really good for this, Savannah River or INEL in Idaho Falls, Idaho, or the Hanford out in Washington. There's facilities that already have a lot of infrastructure and community support and have been working with nuclear energy for a really long time. And so the Department of Energy is looking at all these different sites to pick the best one. And what they want to do is they want to build a research facility, a research reactor, kind of together, so that they would have a fast breeder reactor on a small scale coupled to some sort of research facility. And they want to build a reprocessing facility, and then they want to build a large production style fast breeder reactor. And
hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment, Steve.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Steve is saying that this global nuclear energy project, it's got a function of the Department of Energy, and they actually have a rush plan right now, and they're looking for the ideal site to put in the reprocessing plant, where, of course, they'll reprocess the fuel that is all out across the country, and they're going to make it into fuel that can be utilized again, which would be the logical thing. We should have been doing it for the last 35 years. We've not been allowed to, thanks to Jimmy Carter. And the next step is going to be to pick that site. How soon do you think they're going to be able to begin reprocessing the nuclear fuel that's out there?
Well, DOE does not have a very good track record for meeting milestones. They don't manage their facilities, at least in my opinion, very well. And the two big black eyes that DOE has right now are the vitrification plant in Washington and the Yucca Mountain burial site in Nevada.
How much do they spend on that burial site? Is it be of absolutely no use at all?
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
We're talking about billions of dollars bury the fuel that should have been reprocessed. Ladies and gentlemen, they just love to waste the taxpayers' money. No private corporation could operate like the government does, and there's no problem facing America today that a new government program won't make worse. Why don't they get private industry just to go ahead and do this and let them make a profit on it?
Well, I can't answer that question. I have no idea. But I can tell you that at the Hanford site where I work, they are building one of the world's largest vitrification plants, which is also a way over budget, way over timeline thing. But it is moving forward and will hopefully eventually be done. And a vit plant is very important to the whole reprocessing idea. That one of the bad things about reprocessing is that it creates a lot of waste byproduct. And so the way they reprocess the fuel, they take this spent nuclear fuel and they essentially dissolve it in really nasty chemicals, and extremely caustic and extremely acidic, so they, it sort of alternates as it goes through the flow path, and really nasty organic solvents, and they essentially take these very heavy metals and they dissolve them, and then they separate them out of solution into the form that they want them in. And so this process creates a bunch of bad liquid waste. And so some of the waste can be treated. You know, you can mix acids and bases together and you end up with water. But some of the waste ends up needing to be stored. And Hanford, I don't know if you're, well, I know a lot of the 8 o'clock listeners are very familiar with Hanford, but in California probably not. Hanford is a very large facility, greater than 500 square miles. And a big portion of it was used to create plutonium back in the Cold War for building bombs. If several shut down reactors, that was their sole facility. They never made electricity. They just made plutonium. And then they have had three different processing facilities over the years. And each of them, they got better and better with their waste production. But some of the early ones made a lot of waste. And what they did with it is they buried it in these huge underground tanks. And so currently they have, I don't know, over 150 million gallon tanks that are underground and full of some of this nasty stuff. And you know, given the technology of the 40s, some of these tanks are single-shelled tanks. And some of them have leaked. And so, that you know, there's a lot of environmental concerns that go along with some of this stuff leaking out and getting into the water table or getting into the Columbia River. So the vitrification plant, what it does is it takes this liquid waste and it vitrifies it into glass. And so instead of an unstable liquid form, you get a stable glass log. And then the glass log will go for disposal, burial, probably at Yucca Mountain if Nevada ever opens the gates down there. And so it's important to have a vitrification facility wherever they do the reprocessing it at, so that they can minimize the collection of this type of waste and put it into a more stable form. And Hanford has not only the vitrification plant, but they have a reprocessing facility that was built in the 70s and completed in the 80s and has never been used. It's completely uncontaminated. There's the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act went through before it ever went online, so it's a brand new facility. And it happens to sit right next door to a fast reader reactor that has been shut down and has been in the process of deactivation, but is still salvageable. It actually only ran for about 10 years. And so Hanford looks real good, and that's why I wanted to come on the show during the 8 o'clock spot, was to let the listeners know in the, you know, the greater Washington area. DOE has a website, gnep.energy.gov. They want your opinions. They have a place to send comments. You can call, you can email, you can fax, or you can write the Department of Energy while they're doing this programmatic environmental impact statement and give them your opinion, plus or minus. There are some organizations and groups out there that are protesting this. They don't want to see anything but cleanup going on in Hanford.
Of course, this is part of the environmental movement. They do not want to see the ability to manufacture electricity, because this whole environmental movement is really an attack on the industrialization of America. They want to destroy the industrial base of America. We have to have power to be manufacture anything at all. We need power for everything, from our computers to the electric lights to the air conditioning to electric heat. And these people They know exactly what they're doing on the other side. They want to destroy existing civilization. And if you read things like the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992 at Rio de Janeiro, and we've summarized that in our Sustainable Development Syllabus, they really want to destroy Western civilization. When you understand that, it all makes sense. They don't want you to produce electricity with coal. They don't want you to produce electricity with oil. They want to tear down the dam so that the fishies can swim up and down, and, of course, so you can't produce electricity. And the last thing they would want would be the logical solution, and that would be nuclear power plants. So they're going to demonstrate against everything. Now, these environmentalists are being funded by people of great wealth, by our great tax-exempt foundations, and many times by certain even branches of our own government, who are all part of this whole movement which is aligned against industrialized society, against Western civilization. When you understand that this is an attack on Western civilization and industrialized society, it all makes sense. And I think anybody out there in the audience is going to have to decide which side they want to be on. On the side of those people who want to destroy Western civilization and our industrial base and impoverish our people, or whether they want to go ahead and do what is logical, and if the demo was logical back in the 70s, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today.
No, and you know, Stan, I'm kind of an environmentalist at heart. I guess growing up in Santa Cruz, it sort of clings to you like a disease or something. But the groups that protest, I think that you're absolutely right, that the leaders, they know full well what's going on. But I think that even more sad than their dishonesty is that they really rally a lot of people that are just concerned about the world that we live in.
Absolutely.
And they get these people really excited, and they get very impassioned, and they get very vocal and very vehement. They don't understand what they're talking about because they're listening to somebody that's not telling them the truth. And I encourage people to look kind of at both sides of the equation here. Nuclear energy is not—it's not something to goof around with. There's a lot of mess. Hanford has a lot of mess. There's a lot of things that need to be done and need to be cleaned up. But I really think that the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, at least the ideals behind it, are what our country needs for energy, or what our country needs for environmental cleanup and efficiency. And the other part of the program that we didn't even get into is that part of this GNEP is that we will give reactors and fuel to non-nuclear countries, and they will give us their spent nuclear fuel back, and it'll go through our reprocessing cycle. And this is part of the selling point of this Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, is to get the world, you know, our big, happy global family here, off of its addiction to oil and get it into nuclear, but that America will control the flow of fuel. And what they want to prevent, they don't mind countries having nuclear reactors, as far as I can tell. What they want to prevent are countries from developing the technologies to enrich the fuel, to process or reprocess fuel themselves. And so, you know, America wants to hold the stick, and they don't mind people having, it seems, at least with this program here, that they don't mind people having the nuclear power, but they don't want it to make bombs out of it.
All right, now, Chris, the interesting thing is the price of uranium has just skyrocketed. You know, a few, 3 or 4 years ago, the price of uranium, $3 or $4 or $5 a pound. Uranium has gone up to $90 a pound because the people, certainly out there all across the world, are beginning to put in nuclear power plants. They're building them in China. They're building them in India. They're building them in countries all throughout the world. So the price of uranium has really skyrocketed. The thing is that once, of course, you begin to process all of this spent fuel that you have, really, of course, won't this tend to actually provide a lot of the fuel that's needed? So we're not going to have all these new uranium mines. What are your thoughts on that? Have you thought about it, Steve?
Oh yeah, before GNEP even came along, I mean, I've had discussions along the lines of the discussion we're having way back into the early 90s when I first got into the nuclear industry. And reprocessing with a breeder reactor program is exactly what the country needs. You're right, uranium becomes more expensive. It is technically a fixed resource. I've been trying to half-heartedly, because I'm listening to you and sort of looking online here, to get the amount of energy that a gram of uranium versus a barrel of oil is. And I'll give you like a number that comes off the top of my head. I think that it's like a kilogram of uranium to like 150,000 drums of oil. There's a huge energy disparity between oil and uranium. But technically uranium is a fixed resource, because the only isotope of uranium that we use is 235. But if you have a breeder reactor program, you know, 99% of all the uranium in the world is uranium-238. So you start turning uranium-238 into plutonium-239, which is a usable fuel. And now your technically limited resource just became unlimited. And as you start breeding fuel, you don't need to mine for uranium anymore. You have a huge surplus. And then the other byproduct of these types of reactors is that they can create medical isotopes, very short-lived, very useful in cancer treatments at a scale that's just mind-boggling. FFTF, the facility, that's the fast flux test facility in Hanford, they did a run where they produced some gadolinium, which is a medical isotope that before FFTF did their run, it was like $1,000 a gram or something. And in one shot, in 1 month, FFTF made so much of this gadolinium, which is, it's a short-lived medical isotope, that it dropped the price of the isotope down to, I don't know, like $4 or $5 a gram, because, you know, there's just not enough of a demand for this one thing, and they just flooded the market with it all of a sudden. And so, but they can do that with all kinds of isotopes, and they can create new isotopes that are very, very short-lived. You know, and you want radiation in your body as short a time as possible. So if you create an isotope of iodine or thorium or something that'll target a specific cancer area, you want to make that isotope as short-lived as possible, so it gets in, it does what it needs to do, and then it disappears. And these breeder reactors can do stuff like that too.
Well, I really think it's sort of an exciting thing. I think it's very, 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 very satisfying to realize that they're going to do what they should have done 30 years ago. That has been effectively blocked by the environmental lobby. But, ladies and gentlemen, understand that the environmental lobby has been funded by our great tax-exempt foundations, who are, of course, intent upon destroying the infrastructure of our nation, by the great oil companies, who are working hand-in-glove with them, in many instances, by branches of our government that, under one guise or another, will go ahead and certainly fund this sort of these radical environmentalists. And believe me, there are people there who are, you know, they're like a watermelon. They're green on the outside, but they're red on the inside. Their goal is the destruction of contemporary civilization. We've got Jack on the line. Jack, do you have a quick question for our guest before? We're almost out of time.
Yes, real quick. I heard a fellow, Dr. David Brown, who first appeared in the conference on future energy that Eugene Melov of Integrity Research Institute held in 99. Dr. Brown has nuclearsolutionscompany.com as the website. Librarian said, yeah, it's valid, it's there. Art Bell had this guy on his show. He appeared on Good Morning America. He has a system that can process the most toxic radioactive waste into a totally inert matter within something like a half an hour.
Okay, fine. Well, certainly I hope that he can get to the Department of Energy. Thanks very much. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Watsonville. Tony, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yes, I wanted to ask if that type of fuel could power an automobile.
All right. Is there any way that we could use it to power automobiles, do you think?
Well, yes, in a roundabout way. If you look at an electric automobile, your battery operated or your hybrid type cars, they're not running off of a magical source of electricity. They're running off of oil, because oil and coal are powering our electric plants. And so when you plug the battery in to charge it up, you're using coal or oil or some other fossil fuel. With nuclear power, if it's supplying the grid, then it can supply your vehicle. You can't do it directly. The Army tried it once back in the 50s with a tank, and it was really a bad experiment.
You have to, it would be too difficult, of course, because it's basically a steam engine, Tony. But thanks very much for calling. And let's, right now, because our guest has been Steve Hettinger, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Steve, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
I found my numbers on conversions of oil or comparisons of oil to uranium. So it's in tons, so you just have to think about it a little bit, I guess. 300 tons of oil produces 700 to 900 tons of carbon dioxide when it's burned. Now, the same 300 tons of oil is equivalent to 0.003 tons of uranium, a very, very small quantity, which produces, of course, no CO2. And so it's a very efficient fuel source. Nuclear reactors have been proven over the last 60 years to be very safe, very effective. They do produce an element of waste that needs attention, needs to be dealt with, but we have the technology, we have the infrastructure, we have the ability to minimize the waste and to keep the environment safe and to protect the public. And so I encourage everybody, particularly in the Northwest, to visit the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership DOE website to submit their comments. I think you can do so until the end of April or something, mid-April maybe. But check it out. Learn about it. You know, don't be an uneducated person in the public that wanders around listening to what other people tell them.
And I think really what's so exciting, Steve, and I think I've learned quite a bit tonight myself, and one of that is this idea of the breeder plant, so that we're not going to have to continue mining large amounts of uranium. We can take the uranium that's already there and, of course, begin converting it into something useful. They have large supplies of depleted uranium, and now they're using that in the munitions because they just didn't know what to do with it. Why, we wouldn't even need to do that. We could utilize that in our breeder reactors and create really more fuel. Is that right?
Right. Create more electricity, get rid of the waste, clean up the environment. It all works together in one neat little package.
And, of course, it can be done so cheaply and so efficiently, and that is the reason that it's been blocked all this time by the people who have the corner on the coal and oil industry. They didn't want the competition. And now, of course, at this time in history, we're really seeing the whole thing beginning to do a flip-flop. And suddenly, I think within the next year or two, you're going to be hearing the wonderful things about nuclear power. And understand, this should have been done a long time ago. It wasn't done because the people who control the media and the people who control the industry didn't want it done. Good night, Steve. Thanks very much. Give my best to the family.
All right. Thanks for having me, Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope that you enjoyed the program this evening. We do have a couple of four-tape sets to sort of go along with this whole idea. We put together a four-tape set on the oil crisis. It's really rather fascinating to see how the whole oil crisis was artificially created. If you haven't read my newsletters, they're up on the Internet. Or if you'd like, if you do get those four-tape set on oil, you could certainly request the newsletters I've written on the oil crisis, part one and part two, and we'd be glad to send those to you. The electricity crisis, that was one of the greatest scams of all time. Do you remember how we were going to deregulate electricity to get the price of electricity down? Do you remember that? Oh, if we can just bring competition into the electricity market, why, we can get the price down. And, you know, everybody wants lower prices, and everybody supported that. And voila, what happened? The price of electricity doubled. Oh, shucks, how did that happen? Well, you need, of course, to listen to our 4-tape set on electricity. You need to, of course, read our syllabus. We put together a syllabus at that time on the electricity crisis. How you can create a problem when there's no problem exists. I personally talked to people highly placed in the electricity industry and having to do with delivering of electricity. They told me how cheap it was to produce electricity. You had to work very hard to do such a bad job unintentionally. And then, of course, you had people like Enron and the others who were gaming the system and making money hand over fist. Well, if you're interested in knowing more about either the oil situation, the oil crisis, phony, there's more oil in the world, they know what to do with, or the electricity crisis, which is a man-made crisis, or simply this whole idea of sustainable development, and, of course, the idea that there are too many people in the world, we're going to have to kill most of them off, why you need to get our sustainable development syllabus, video and 4-tape set, and of course my talk on planned population reduction or population control. We have one DVD or video on planned population reduction, another one just on a population reduction, and we tell you all about the Georgia Guidestones, where the master plan is laid out by the occultists to kill off over 90% of the world's population. You need to get my material on the population control, 4-tape set on population control. My monograph, it's called the Population Control Agenda Monograph. Now that's available up on the internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. But let me suggest that you go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. There's so much up there that you need to know, you need to read, you need to study. We have a number of newsletters on genetic engineering, on population control, how they're using vaccines to damage our children. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, people say, why, nobody would want to damage a child. We love children. Oh, is that so? Well, then, if we love children, why have we killed almost 50 million unborn children in the last, since 1973. Why is it that there are people who want to kill partially born children? Rip the, you know, just simply suck out their brains. No, there really are people who hate children because they hate humanity. And until you understand what energizes these people, you can't understand what's going on. I think one of the best things we have available is something that's quite new. It's called the Forbidden Secret. It's a talk we have, and we have a syllabus that goes with that. We're going to change the name of the syllabus to Forbidden Secret and maybe work on it a little bit. But the talk is very, very revealing. It is the subsequent talk to my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't seen that or read the book, we recommend it. But this new talk, I think, is so important that we're going to, of course, encourage people to listen to it before we have a chance to write the book on the subject. You need to understand why we're in the Middle East today. You need to understand where the world is moving. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because we are at war today. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hill, this is Archer Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening our guest is Congressman William Dannemeyer, who served 14 years in the House of Representatives as one of the leaders of the Republican Party when he decided to run for the Senate. And, of course, he would be so much better off if he was the senator representing California than the senators we have at the present time. But, of course, William Dannemeyer is a man who loves America. He's a man of integrity, a man I'm proud to call a friend. And, well, that's not the sort of people that the establishment really wants sitting in the United States Senate. They would rather have people like Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer who'll go along with the agenda. And, of course, Congressman Dannemeyer always stood on principle. Bill Dannemeyer, thank you. Bill Dannemeyer, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be talking with you. I'm sitting here in the dark in my house.
Well, what happened? Did they know you were going to be on the program tonight?
Well, it's, you know, Satan did it all, you know. But well, there's an automobile accident in the center of Fullerton. The lights have been out since 11 this morning.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Will you be able to do the program?
Well, I think so.
I don't think you'll have any problem. I think that you can talk with the lights on and the lights off. And
some of my opponents would probably say he talks with the light like the lights are out anyway.
Well, tell me, what have you done now? You've been out of Congress since, what, about 1988?
Oh, no, well, it seems that long. No, since 92.
92, okay.
And I, in 94, I organized a group called Americans for Voluntary School Prayer with David Barton. And we got a vote in the House on the constitutional amendment to allow voluntary prayer in public school in 1998. And won it 224 to 203, which was about two-thirds. And we weren't able to bring it to vote in the Senate. And then I continued to work and have until the early part of last year on the same issue. I believe that the principal problem facing America is a spiritual one. We've lost our way. Our moral compass has been tilted, and for two generations we have taught children in public schools there is no God. And there are no standards. You can do anything you want to, and that has consequences, man. And so, but I was hopeful. I was very much enthused by the election. In November of 2004, that was the year that I think Bush was reelected the second term in the beginning, and the Republicans increased their majority in the Senate, Republicans of 51 to 55, and continued to control of the House. This was a very historical, remarkable turn in American politics because it marked the first time in more than 40 years, that the Republican Party was in control of both houses of Congress and the White House at the same time. And so I was hopeful, frankly, that in the 109th Congress, the one that convened in 2005 and 2006, that we get a bill passed. And a number of us worked on a bill called the Constitutional Restoration Act in 2005.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
You betcha.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Congressman William Dannemeyer. He was, has been in the Congress until 1992, 14 years there. And anyway, he was just saying that he was working working on this legislation. They hoped they'd be able to get it through the previous session of Congress. Did you get any support from the president for your efforts?
Not one bit. I never could break through his palace guard, and it was a statute stand. You know, under the Constitution, the Congress, if they have the courage, can use Article 3, Section 2 to accept what subject matter they choose to accept from the jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's been used a half a dozen times in the history of the Republic since 1789. And it's not limited, you know, to minor or major matters. It can be used. When the Republicans at the beginning of the last Congress, in the early part of 2005, allowed a Specter from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, Senator Specter, to be chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, that killed the whole thing. Let me just tell you my assessment of the composite thinking of members of the U.S. Senate. They don't give a darn what any people of America think about anything. They are motivated and driven by one central theme, that's to establish an amiable working relationship with their peers. And you and I, the taxpayers and the little people of America, can just get lost. Pay our taxes and shut up. This is the way I read them. Because, see, as soon as Bill, Senator Frist and McConnell in the last Congress allowed Specter to become chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the issue was dead. He's totally opposed to any ability of people of faith in America, whether what faith they have, to express themselves and acknowledge that God exists. And that was killed. He knew that. I mean, Frist and McConnell knew that, and I don't think they ever had a vision of what they had done or what they haven't done. And another guy that I think he's on the Senate Judiciary Committee is John Kyle from Arizona. He just didn't care.
Well, of course, you've got the Tom Coburn there. He's about the only senator I really have much in the way of confidence in.
Yeah, Tom's got a lot of guts.
We'll be back in just a moment here.
You betcha.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with Bill Dannemeyer. He knows these people. He's worked with these people back in Washington, D.C., and he's just saying that it is his impression in the United States Senate that the senators really don't care what you want, what the American people want. They want to get along, they want to have a nice relationship with one another, and they're quite willing to put unscrupulous people into key positions. And I had simply mentioned one senator who I have the utmost faith in. He happens to be a physician, Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma.
Right.
A man of integrity in a house of shame.
Well, see, this issue I'm talking about, namely reinstating voluntary prayer in public schools in America, or allowing a valedictorian of a public high school graduating class to give witness to his or her faith, whatever happened to be when they gave their speech. Acknowledge that God exists in the public square. 75% of the American people, Democrat, Republican, want that to happen. And you would think that would be of interest to members, elected members of the U.S. Senate? Forget it. They don't care. I hate to say that, but that's not all of them. But that's the basic mentality of my read of the existing members of the U.S. Senate.
Because it's my read is that there's a conspiracy against God, that there are people who hate Christianity, who hate God, and that's why they're that place where they have.
Well, Specter is such a man.
I certainly agree with you on that. He's certainly one of the most wicked men we have around, and I followed his career for many years. Well, anyway, then, of course, you weren't able to get the legislation through for voluntary prayer. And here's where, of course, the president could have intervened, but he didn't. certainly with majorities in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, had the Republican Party stood for what most people think they stand for, there wouldn't have been any problem. But unfortunately, the Republicans are supposed to stand for, you know, you said the limited government, and yet they expanded the government, you know, as bad as the Democrats did. They're supposed to stand for, you know, limited spending and a balanced budget and the biggest deficits we've ever had. And now they've got us involved in this war over there in the Middle East. And do you think that's why they lost their position? Do you think people didn't want the war and they were really voting more against the Republicans than in favor of the Democrats?
I think there are two factors that came together that turned over control of Congress last November. One is the war. The American people have lost confidence in the leadership of the Bush administration. I think the president lied to the American people about the existence of wars of weapons of mass destruction, and also the issue of spending. I mean, I've talked to so many Republicans and friends of mine living here in Orange County in Southern California who just shake their heads. I tell you what happened to them. For the first 3 or 4 years when the Republicans took over Congress in 94, they really stuck to their principles of trying to tame the monster. But you know what happened to them? The virus of power trumped their commitment to fiscal integrity. And they would do anything to keep those perks and their power and their majority status and let the deficit take care of itself. And I think the American public had enough of it and threw them out.
God, isn't that really such a shame? That class of 94 was really... they had an opportunity to change the country, and a few of them did what was right. They pledged that they'd go home at the end of 6 years. They would not become professional politicians. Yeah. And certainly we saw that with the Tom Coburn. He, at the end of 6 years, he said, "I'm through with Congress, I'm going home." Well, now he did come back to run for the Senate simply because a lot of people asked him to, but he didn't want to be a professional politician. Certainly we saw this with a handful of others who at the end of 6 years said, "We pledged we were not here to stay. We didn't want the perks. We were here to serve."
Yep.
And they forgot what it was all about.
Well, Coburn is he's a rare breed. He has the courage to really try to tame runaway spending and a lot of other issues. But you got to be careful in that forum that you, as a young member of the Senate, you're not perceived as being too active. You're supposed to stand around the corner and wait for 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 years till you get some seniority. Tom Coburn's not that kind of guy. He's gonna pick his shots, and he's gonna be heard from.
Amen to that. Well, I don't know if they'd be reelected next time around, but he certainly, at least the senators know where he's coming from.
Yeah.
It's just a shame the American people never hear his message.
And I think the war issue, Stan, I don't know how you read it or not, but I will share with your listening audience, I think the principal reason that American military forces are in Iraq is for the purpose of using the U.S. military as a means of expanding the boundaries of the existing state of Israel to what they were in Old Testament times, from the River Nile to the River Euphrates.
All right. Well, we would probably disagree on that, but that's all right. We've always been friends. We haven't always agreed, yeah. But on most things we would. I believe that we're there as a basis for getting into a war with Iran and expanding the war in the Middle East, and which will lead to the destruction of Israel as a nation, or at least severely injure it, and there will be mass destruction. I'm expecting hundreds of thousands of Israelis to be killed before our leaders get through with them. But it'll be interesting to see what happens, and I fear we're moving towards a major crisis. So we'll see who's right in the near future.
Well, I think, Stan, on that point, you know, I am impressed by former President Jimmy Carter. He's not my favorite president by any means, but even a stop clock can be right twice a day. He wrote a book recently, you probably heard of it, his piece, is that he wants, it's peace, not apartheid. And I think Jimmy Carter has a little bit of favor to return politically to the Zionist Jews, because back in 1980, you know, he Carter enjoyed their support when he first was elected in 1976. But then Carter, I think, was trying to get some sense in the Israeli leadership to stop beating up on the Palestinians. And the Zionist Jews said, hey, this guy isn't, isn't our guy, so they dumped him and backed Reagan. And Carter knew that, and I think that's one of the reasons that Reagan got elected.
Well, I think that it's very interesting as we see this thing unfolding. What do you think is going to happen as far as the war in the Middle East is concerned, Bill?
Well, the neocons, I know one of the best books that I've seen on this whole subject was written by Michael Collins Piper, called The High Priests of War. And if your listeners would like to get a copy, it's only about 110 pages, $20 or something, on American Free Press, you can get it on the Internet and get a copy and read it. And Piper is an excellent researcher and writer. And he describes these neocons. That's the abbreviation for conservative. They're not conservative. They're Trotskyite communists. And they've taken over control of the United States government, whether we want to admit it to ourselves or not. But the government of Israel, through these neocons in high positions of the American government, is running America. And that's what the book says, The High Priests of War, but I believe it. And in other words, Israel, a small country, has got leading America through the snows in this war in Iraq. And it deals with whether we consider, you know, there's no question that in the Old Testament that Abraham's promise was to a certain area from the river Euphrates to the river Nile, the Old Testament boundaries. But that the issue was that conditional or unconditional? I believe it was a conditional promise, and the Jewish leadership, the time of Christ, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they rejected Jesus, and I think they lost the right to that land at that time when they crucified Jesus Christ.
Well, now, if that indeed is the case, why is it the United States is pressuring Israel to withdraw from the occupied land? Why are we pressuring them to pull out of Gaza? Why are we pressuring to give up Judea and Samaria? And why, when, of course, they were certainly in the recent war with Lebanon, did we pressure them to lose that war? I mean, if the Zionists really control Washington, D.C., why didn't we let them go ahead and fight the war and see how it was going to turn out?
Well, I'm not sure you put your finger on the right question, Stan, because we're still there. American military forces are there. The Bush administration has got egg all over their face because of what the neocons promised to President Bush and the other members of the administration with respect to what happened in Iraq hasn't worked out very well. So now they're planning. They got a huge naval force around the waters around Iran, and they think they want to bomb Iran. I hope that God won't let them do that, but we'll see what happens.
Well, what happens, of course, if this ends up with some sort of a massive war on Israel? And certainly everything would suggest that, you know, if we do get into a war with Iran, why, certainly Hezbollah and Hamas and Syria and Jordan and Egypt will all attack Israel, and in the present state of their preparedness, I don't see any way, without God's intervention, that they could possibly survive.
Well, I think Jimmy Carter, as I say, made a good point that the center of the controversy in Israel today and Palestine is that the Israelis are beating up on the Palestinians big time and have been doing so for decades, since Israel was recognized in 1948. And that has to stop. I don't know that Israel is prepared to do that.
Well, I know, but do you think the Palestinians are prepared to live in peace with the Israelis?
I think so, Stan. I think that's the key to that peace of that region of the world. And
well, of course, Hamas has said that they will never agree to Israel existing as a nation. We're going to be back in just a moment with my good friend, Congressman William Dodemeyer. Okay, Congressman William Dannemeyer here. But Hamas has said that they will never agree to the existence of Israel as a free state. So, and it's not, you know, will give us the land and acknowledge that, you know that we have a right to be Palestinians and live in the land. But the Hamas, and certainly it's a contingent within the Palestinians, is say, we will never agree to allow to have live in peace with the Israelis. So if they will never agree to live in peace with the Israelis, can the Israelis agree to live in peace with them?
Well, that's a very difficult question, but...
That's the key question of this whole issue.
I think that if the perception is that America is leaning on the Israeli leadership to respect the rights of the Palestinian to live in that land and not be subject to the massacres that they have experienced, I think that's a chance for peace there.
But, of course, isn't the American government leaning on Israel? Weren't they really behind the pressure to pull out of Gaza? Isn't the American government responsible for the pulling back of the putting pressure on Israel to pull back from the settlements? Isn't the American government responsible for the effort to force, settlements out of Samaria and Judea? So isn't the American government putting pressure on Israel to make all the concessions to the Palestinians, which I don't think the average Israeli necessarily supports, but isn't the American government putting terrible pressure on the Israelis today?
Well, I guess I could say they're not enough because the peace settlement hasn't come. I'd like to broaden this discussion a little bit beyond what you and I are talking about.
All right.
Israel and Palestine are important. I don't deny that for a moment. But what we are witnessing in the world today is the culmination of an effort that was begun by Adam Weishaupt several hundred years ago.
All right.
That's the Illuminati. And the American branch of the Illuminati is a CFR in New York, headed by David Rockefeller. About 3,000 members and about 70% of them are Jews. And they're the ones that control the senior appointments to the Democrat or Republican administration in our lifetime. I'm talking about State and Treasury and the National Security Council and so on. And these Zionist Jews, they don't care which president is there, the Republican or Democrat, they control each side. The reality is, in our lifetime, Stan, you can't get elected president unless you have sold your soul to the Zionist Jews. They run America through the pressure and influence brought by the CFR, the Illuminati office in the United States. And we need to recognize that, the leadership of that organization, they are dedicated to achieving the New World Order. The New World Order, the Illuminati, has two goals. The first one is to destroy all governments, and the second is to destroy all religions. That's what their goal is. And they want the New World Order here in America. And you know what happens if you disagree with the New World Order? You're shot, and then you're at peace, because they promise peace. And one of the books that I've read in the last 10 or 15 years is by Professor Rummel. He's on the staff of the University of Hawaii, called Death by Government. I don't know if they read it or not.
Yes, I have. We've even interviewed him.
And he came up with some very interesting statistical data.
Hold that thought just a moment.
You bet.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I've got Congressman William Dannemeyer, and go right ahead with your thing. He was talking about a book written by Professor Rummel called Death by Government, which goes into the fact that it is government that has created the greatest genocides of all time, and certainly over the last 100 years or so, all of the major genocides have been coordinated by governments. So pick the story up, Bill.
Yeah, that's to give it a little perspective, that in the 20th century, more people died in the world at the hands of their own governments than died in wars between nation states. I'm not suggesting for the moment that wars between nation states are a good thing. But I believe that when we look at the actions of how governments have killed people, the Soviet Union, for instance, the millions of Christians that were killed there by the Soviet Jewish leadership of that country, and just to name a few, and the tells me that the best chance for the survival of freedom is in a country like the United States that we grew up in as kids and love so much, as I do. That we have a better chance of preserving freedom for ourselves and our kids as a national government, and get the UN out of the U.S. and the U.S. out of the U.N.
Well, you know, the thing about if you go and you study the original Bolshevik government under Lenin, why the majority of the people who were involved in the initial Communist Party with Lenin that were Jewish. But you know the most amazing thing is, I think only one of them died a natural death. All the rest of them were executed, so maybe it's not such a good idea to be a Jewish leader in a communist state, or you may very well get executed. So that is true now. You can't send, and you know, certainly, if you look at the disciples of Jesus Christ, Bill, almost every one of them was a Jew. Is Christianity a Jewish conspiracy?
No, they weren't a Jew. They were a Judean. They were at that time. They were Judeans.
All right. Most people would think that the disciples of Christ were Jewish. They came from Judea.
The transfer from the status of a Judean didn't take place till the King James Bible was written in about the 16th century, when the term Judean was changed to Jew. And those people, originally they were Israelites, and then they became Judeans.
Well, you know, because under communism, there were many times they'd had major purges of the Jews there, just exactly as they had under the Tsars. Certainly, you know, the Tsars, they had the pogroms, which were actually a Jewish cleansing, and they had that certainly under Stalin. We actually targeted Jews and had arrested just because they were Jewish.
Well, you talk about the pogroms in Russia. Has you ever heard of Myron Fagan?
Right, sure. I knew. I'd never met him, but I have all of his writings.
Right. And he talks in the... he has two cassette tapes on the Illuminati. And he described how Jacob Schiff was sent by the Rothschilds to America to take over the American banking system. And he had a problem at the time because he wanted to take over the control of the two American parties, the Republican and the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party won most of the presidential elections since the Civil War. So Jacob Schiff was instrumental in getting the communist Jewish leadership of the Soviet Union in the last part of the 20th century to institute the pogroms in the Soviet Union Jewish areas in order to drive the Jews out of Russia who came to America and then settled in a number of our major cities. Okay. To build up the registration and voting power of the Democratic Party.
In other words, there was no pogrom foot allowed by the Tsar?
No. It was instituted by the activities of Jacob Schiff.
I see. Okay, I've never heard that.
That's what Myron Fagan said, among other things, in describing the history of the Illuminati in the world. The last 200 years.
Myron Fagan was very anti-Jewish. For instance, most people have never really studied the background of the Council on Foreign Relations and where it came from. I mean, who originated this movement that became the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, it was organized right after World War I.
Right, of course. And who organized it?
Well, it was the American branch of the Illuminati called the Council on Foreign Relations. David Rockefeller was part of it.
Wait a minute, David Rockefeller? That was 1921. You mean David Rockefeller was organizing that at that time?
Well,
he must have been awful young at that time.
Oh yeah, it's the Rockefeller influence in New York City that brought it about.
No, really, of course, it was really an outgrowth, because I've got a book written by the gentleman who was actually in Paris after the First World War. His name was Frederick Howe. And, of course, he was there with a group known as the Inquiry, and the Inquiry, of course, was established by Colonel House. And, of course, certainly, have you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness?
I have it on my desk. I'm starting to read it.
Okay, fine. Well, basically, of course, he ran into a group of young men who were known as Milner's Kindergarten. And they said, look, I mean, we have the First World War has destroyed the youth of Great Britain. We've lost a whole generation of the graduates of Harrow and Eton, of Cambridge and of Oxford. And America's going to have to take up the leadership of this move to create a world government. And, of course, Frederick Howe really thought the First World War had to do with economic imperialism. And they told him, no, you don't understand. The First World War was all about noblesse oblige, the white man's burden to rule the world. And it was out of those meetings between Frederick Howe and then the members of the Inquiry, and then a group known as Milner's Kindergarten, that the Council on Foreign Relations was organized in the United States in 1921 as a front for the Round Table Group, which was the small group I mentioned, and, of course, for J.P. Morgan, who may very well have been related to the Rothschilds. And certainly comparable groups were formed in England, known as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And really these two groups, the Royal Institute and the Council on Foreign Relations, have been more or less the invisible government of the world since that time. But it's fascinating to actually know where this Miller's Roundtable came from. And it came from a secret society. I went back to Georgetown University and spent weeks going through the papers of a man named Professor Carol Quigley. Do you know Professor Quigley?
I know of him. He wrote a book
called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the
World
of Our Time. He was Bill Clinton's mentor.
Right.
He explained to Bill Clinton who really ran the world. And certainly he recognized the influence of the Jewish bankers, but he also recognized the fact that there were a lot of bankers who were not Jewish. For instance, the Giannini's. You remember the Giannini's? The Bank of America?
Well, we talked about who organized the CFR after World War One. It was the same crowd that snuck through the creation of the Federal Reserve System, that private banking oligarchy that has stolen America. That
You're
was in 1913.
Right. Who were they? They were, of course, Nelson Aldrich.
Yeah, Nelson Aldrich was a senator that they put that through.
Hold that thought just a moment here.
You betcha.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and with us this evening is Congressman William Dannemeyer, and we're just talking about some of the history, and Congressman Dannemeyer feels that there's a very, very strong Zionist influence in what's going on in the world, and certainly there's a Zionist influence, but then there's a Catholic influence, and there's certainly a very, very strong Protestant influence. Certainly it would appear that the Bush family is Protestant, and I certainly don't disagree with them, but is there some sort of a common denominator behind all of these movements, which is moving us towards this one world government that I'm sure that Congressman Dannemeyer and I am very, very concerned about. So I'm hoping
I'm more than concerned. I'm opposed to it, Stan.
May I?
I'm opposed to this new world order.
I know, and so am I, Bill. I just hope you'll read my book.
Yeah, I will.
I hope that maybe it'll introduce you to a perhaps a little different. How do you put this whole thing together? Are there other organizations out there that most people are totally unaware of that are even more influential than any of the groups we've talked about?
Well, Jacob Schiff, who was the lead voice in Kuhn and Loeb, headquartered in New York City, he was Rothschild's point man to take over the American banking system, and got the deed done on December 23, 1913, when Nelson Aldrich pushed through the adoption of the Federal Reserve Act, when the members of Congress, except for two or three in the House and the Senate, had all gone home for Christmas. It passed, I haven't checked the record for sure, but I believe it will show I haven't got a copy of it yet, but I'm checking that out. I believe it will show that it passed by unanimous consent. And the way it's a total ignorance of the whole process of accountability by Congress. You just don't pass major legislation stand on unanimous consent where there isn't a roll call vote. And they did it deliberately because they, you know, they wanted to push that thing through, and they had their pigeon in the White House. That's President Wilson, who signed it. And see, that's a private corporation. And
well, of course, the question is, who controlled Woodrow Wilson at that time? Because Woodrow Wilson was really controlled. He in fact, it was only later he realized he was controlled, and what a terrible mistake it made. But who controlled Woodrow Wilson at that time?
Well, his own.
What?
There's a fellow named, Benjamin Friedman. You ever heard of him?
Yeah, but the man who controlled Woodrow Wilson was a man named Edward Mandel House.
Right, and you know what they had on Wilson? Is that he had an illicit love affair with a member of his faculty at Princeton University. And some people found some love letters that he had written to his sweetheart outside of marriage, and they used that as a means of cajoling him, Wilson, into going through the subterfuge of getting us into World War One by I think the ship that was allegedly sunk there in the English Channel was the USS Sussex. It was never sunk at all. But Wilson used that as a means of protecting American interests. And the blackmail they used on Wilson is how they got us into World War One. Benjamin Friedman, a Jew, who was a very distinguished member of the business establishment. He made a fortune in the soap business, and he spent his whole fortune trying to tell the American people about what he knew about the corruption in the highest places of the United States government. And he gave this speech in Washington, D.C. in 1961, describing this whole thing.
Well, I hope maybe you'll send me a copy of that. And certainly, here there are Jewish people are very concerned about what's going on. And some Jewish people are wonderful, dedicated Americans.
Well, Myron Fagan was born a Jew, but he became a Christian. And he did another tape, as you may know, called Red Stars Over Hollywood.
Yes, I got everything he ever did. And Fagan was trying to awaken people as to what was going on. But, you know, of course, and I will have to admit, when I first got started on this, I guess it was almost 45 years ago. I mean, I honestly believe that communism was the enemy. I believe that the communists really threatened America.
Yeah.
And I did not realize at that time that starting in 1918, the United States government was funding the communist regime, and it's still funding it today. In fact, there would not be a Soviet Union if it hadn't been funded by the Federal Reserve System and American banks and American corporations. And I was just reading today, was since 1992, we've given over $9 billion to the Soviet Union. And, of course, all you need to do is look at communist China today. And we have built up this entire, industrial base in communist China to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. It doesn't make any sense. Why would we be doing something so stupid?
Well, I tell you, Fagan talked about that, and what it shows is that the influence, the leadership of the two major parties in American politics and art at this time is clearly in the hands of the New World Order crowd. And their game plan is to transfer jurisdiction over America to unelected bureaucrats in the United Nations, and also I believe that the Zionist Jews have a major voice in the CFR and have, as I say, taken over the leadership of America in this New World Order.
I see. So you don't think there are any other major forces out there besides the Zionist Jews? Would you say
they? Well, no. There's a guy named Siegel, who wrote a book called Christian Zionism, and it talks the whole history of the development of dispensationalism in world politics. And so, for your listening audience, a dispensationalist is probably a Protestant who believes that the Bible teaches that for Christ to come again, Jews have to be in Palestine. I don't think the Bible teaches that, but that's what dispensationalists believe. But in this book, what he says, Stan, is this. This is Jewish sources talking now, not Siegel the author, not Bill Dannemer. This is the Jewish sources are quoted in that book the following. 60-90% of all money coming to the Democratic Party comes from Jews, and 40% of all money coming to Republicans comes from Jews in America. And I believe those figures are true. And since they are, for all practical purposes, the Zionist Jews have bought control of the U.S. Congress, whether you like it or I like it. You watch what Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, does from San Francisco. She lists herself in her biography as a member of a Protestant denomination, but she's a Jew. And maybe she doesn't want to admit it.
Well, but of course you said the migrant Myron Fagan was born Jewish and converted to being Christian.
You bet.
So he's, was he a Jew or was he a Christian?
Well, I think he was a Christian.
Okay, well, so this is what Nancy Pelosi says. Now, I don't like Nancy Pelosi. I think she's playing a part. My concern is that she talks about, of course, being against the war, and then she supports the war. I mean, certainly she led the appropriations to get money to fund the military, $100 billion for a year, with the idea that we're going to pull out next year. If she really wants to pull out, why didn't she withdraw the funds and pull out this year? And why did Nancy Pelosi pull that stipulation from the Defense Appropriation Act that would have said, that actually said, the president cannot attack Iran without the permission of Congress? So obviously she's saying one thing, and she's really favoring the attack on Iran. She's favoring on keeping our troops there at least another year, and who knows where we'll be. I suspect we'll be so deeply involved in another year we're never going to be able to get out.
Well, she's if Congress passes some legislation providing a withdrawal of troops from Iraq, I believe that since George Bush, president, is firmly in hold of the Zionist Jews, he'll veto it. And we'll continue to see the American troops there in Iraq.
What happens, of course, if there's a major attack on Israel as a result of our policies and 100 or 200 or 500,000 Jews are killed?
Pray that that won't happen. God knows.
I fear that it's going to happen. And my concern is that our policies will lead to the destruction of Israel. And, of course, if that's the case, then, of course, those Zionist Jews who are directing it all really aren't very smart.
Well, their weapons, Israel probably has close to 400 nuclear weapons right there in their country. And I don't know that any other nation in the Middle East, Syria or Lebanon or Iraq, I think Iran may have the capability, but I'm not certain about that. I just pray that Bush will come to his senses and not try to attack Iran.
Yeah, well, I certainly would echo that, but I believe that the decision has already been made to attack Iran. In fact, I don't know if you read an article in the New Yorker magazine. If you haven't really, it's worthwhile reading. It's written by Seymour Hersh. And one of the men I really think has a tremendous grasp. It was the March 5th article in the New Yorker magazine. He tells you the decision's already been made. We're going to go to war with Iran. And if he's telling the truth, why, of course, what we're going to be seeing in the not-too-distant future will be some sort of an incident that will be generated that will allow the attack to take place. In fact, one of the most incredible things I've ever read was Zyg Nowosytski's testimony before the Foreign Relations Committee, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he talked about how we were going to engineer an incident to justify an attack on Iran. I mean, a truly unbelievable statement. I never thought I would agree with anything Zyg Nowosytski wrote, but, and you have to ask yourself, why would this man, who is simply a spokesman for the Rockefeller interests and for the same interests that you and I would both oppose, why is he telling us exactly what lies ahead? And in any event, if our listeners want to read that, why, we can provide it for you if you can't get hold of it. That's Zyg Nowosytski's testimony in February of this year before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he talks about an engineered incident to get us into a war with Iran. And, Bill, I fear that a war with Iran will inflame the entire Middle East and will have tremendous ramifications right here in America.
Well, we'll find out. I think that as we speak, there is the capability on the part of naval forces in the waters around Iran to do just that. And as I say, I pray that Bush will come to his senses and not to order them to attack. I think one of the reasons that the neocons, these people that seize control of our government, are really determined to attack Iran relates to a conference that was held last November in Iran, called by the president of that country. And you may have followed that, Stan, where all of the revisionists relating to the Holocaust were at that meeting and spoke, many of them spoke very candidly about questioning the whole Holocaust. And I happen to believe, based on the research that I've developed, and I didn't develop it but read it, is that no one died of gas in a concentration camp in Europe in World War II. The claims are made that 6 million died there, but I don't believe anybody died.
You don't believe anybody died?
No. A lot of people died, Stan.
No, but I mean of gas in the concentration
camp. That's right. A lot of people died of typhus and dysentery and from starvation and what have you. But nobody died from attacks of gas. And there's a Venlam Lichter who went over there, and he's a distinguished, his claim to fame here in America was he was an expert on putting people to death in execution, you know, state prison systems for administering the death penalty. And he went over there in the late 80s and did some investigative work for a guy named Ernst Zundel, who's now sitting in the prison in Mannheim, Germany, as we speak. He's a pacifist, but he's there because he questioned the Holocaust. And this guy, Lichter, he conducted an experiment, because when you use Zyklon B gas in a room, it leaves a residue that can be detected by to demonstrate forensic evidence. And the rooms that were claimed to be in Auschwitz and Birkenau were tested, and there's no measurable residue of Zyklon B gas there. And so that's evidence, I think. And now there's a guy named Forreston in France who came up with the same analysis as well. And so that's, I think, those two people, among others. Zundel was not permitted. He's in jail. He couldn't come to Iran. But the Zionist Jews are deeply concerned about the truth of the Holocaust, because I believe, you know, at one time, the claim is made that 6 million people died in the Holocaust as from gassing. Well, that's not true at all. Of that 6 million, 4 million came from Auschwitz. And the people at Auschwitz themselves have reduced the number who died there to 1.5 million from 4 million. And you would think that if 4 million becomes 1.5 million, that 2.5 should come off the 6. But that's, you know, that gets into the technical side of it. And there's laws in Germany and France and Austria today where you can't even question anything I'm talking about right now. And that's very, very unfortunate. What do these people got to hide? And that's...
Or maybe we're just being intentionally confused about what happened. Have you ever talked to anybody who was actually there at Auschwitz?
I haven't, no.
I have. Well, maybe I'll have to send you a copy of my four-tape set on the real Holocaust. Anyway, Bill, it's been a real pleasure having you here as a guest.
It's always a pleasure, Stan. You're a patriot, and you're a researcher, and you're a good writer.
Yeah, well, I hope you'll read my book, and we'll be glad to get talking to you again sometime. But thank you so very much for being with us.
Nice talking to you.
It's always a pleasure. Our guest this evening has been Congressman William Dannemeyer. We'll be back.
Good night, Stan.
Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly I've known Bill Dannemeyer for many years, and I've always considered him a friend, but as you may suspect, I disagree with him on many of the issues we talked about tonight, and I would simply suggest, I hope any of you out there would read my book on the Brotherhood of Darkness and on the entire Jewish issue. Are there wicked people who are part of the movement towards the New World Order within the Jewish faith? Absolutely. Are the majority of Jewish people in favor of this? Absolutely not. Did the Holocaust take place? Well, I hope many of you would want to get the four-tape set that we have with people who were there. Some of them were Christians. Most of them were Jews who had become Christians. And, of course, one of them was simply a gentleman who was there, who was in Auschwitz, and it's called The Last Sunrise. And I hope that you'll listen to their stories. I believe that they're true, and I believe that the Holocaust did take place. I don't know how many people were killed there, but an awful lot of them were killed, and I believe that they were killed by gassing. But why have they raised the issue? Because they're trying to confuse us, and they're doing a wonderful job of confusing the American people. Why is it illegal to speak out in Germany and in France and many other countries and say the Holocaust didn't take place? Why? Because there is an organized effort to mobilize hatred for the Jewish faith and for the Jewish people today. In fact, the Jewish people, really an amazing people, there are not that many of them around in the world. And yet, in many respects, they're the pivotal to everything going on in the world today. If the Jews really controlled Washington, D.C., and I ask the question, and I would always like to ask it, if they can, these Jews, Zionist Jews who control Washington, D.C., why have they put pressure on the Jewish leaders in Israel to pull back from their total control over the Palestinian area, which they had, and they've given back most of the land that they've captured in war after war? And why did they recently force them to pull out of Gaza, forcing them today to pull out of Judea and Samaria? And of course, they're not very smart people, because they're setting up Israel today to be destroyed in the coming war. Now, I believe that there's no way that Israel is going to survive in the coming war from a military point of view. It cannot be done. But I really do believe, and with all my heart, we're going to see God's intervention in the very near future. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we were talking about, did the Holocaust take place? Well, we hope many of you will want to get the four-tape set available through Radio Liberty, the truth about the Holocaust. We hope you want to get that and listen to my interviews with people who were actually there at Auschwitz and of course, were in the concentration camps and had to live through this nightmare. And many of them lost their families in that. And then, of course, certainly the information that we have on my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, into the background of how this all fits together. This is not a Zionist conspiracy. It's a satanic conspiracy. And there are forces within the Catholic Church, within the Protestant Church, or within the Jewish religion, and certainly within the Muslim faith, and within the Hindu faith, and within the, in every religion throughout the world that are tied into a satanic conspiracy to bring about a one-world government and a new world religion. President Ahmadinejad of Iran is playing a part, as it happens with most of the people on the world stage today. They're all playing a part. Ask yourself logically, I mean, why would President Ahmadinejad be shaking his fist at America and saying, you know, we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. There was no Holocaust. The Western governments are all going to be destroyed. Why would anybody in a sound mind make a statement like that when you have two aircraft carrier groups and the Boxer aircraft carrier group sitting there in the Persian Gulf along with both British and French ships? Why would you really almost invite an attack on your own country? It does not make sense. But then why would we go into Afghanistan to catch Osama bin Laden and then not try to catch Osama bin Laden? Why would we go into Iraq to get weapons of mass destruction when they'd already been moved into Syria? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there were weapons of mass destruction. They've been moved into Syria, where I think they're going to be used on the coming attack on Israel. And of course, we had to justify going into Iraq because Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. But if you study the history of Saddam Hussein, you'll understand that back in 1959, he worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. I've got books written 15 years ago that go into that. And if you haven't read Robert Baer's book, which we still carry today, called See No Evil, he will tell you that all the Iraqi people believe that Saddam Hussein was working for the American government. The American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. None of these things make any sense. If I could suggest my pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911, if I could suggest my newsletters available on the Internet from August through December of 2006, go up, pull them down. You're welcome to copy them, to disseminate them, to try to make some sense of what's going on today. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Probably the two best sources of understanding would be my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness, available in book, DVD, or video, and our most recent talk, Forbidden Secret. It's available, of course, in the DVD, will soon be available in video, but you get this with a syllabus. It's called Immigration Invasion. We're changing the name to Forbidden Secret. There is a secret. It has been passed down through the ages by the elect, by the adepts of the secret societies and the mystery religions, and we reveal that in this almost two-hour talk. It's really quite well done. We hope that you'll want to get it. And then, of course, you'll also want to get the new DVD we have on the secret architecture of America's capital called The Riddles in Stone. Now, if you'd like more information on any of these items, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 for a suggested donation. And then, of course, our website, RadioLiberty.com. Good night. God bless.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.